Okay, we're going to call the meeting to order, the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee. Welcome, members. Today we have a hearing on the governor's budget recommendations. We'll have Commissioner Alice Segrin, who is here, Tom Melcher from the Department of Education, and from the Department of Human Services, we'll have Chuck Johnson and Jerry Kerber. So if Commissioner Segrin, if you want to make your way down, we'll do a little bit of committee business. We were going to have our fiscal analyst, Mr. Adrian, talk about the numbers a little bit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I'll go really quickly. I'm sure everyone wants to hear from the agencies. But if you look at your spreadsheet, that looks like this. It should be in your packets. Just quickly go over some of the updates and changes that are in here. The first thing that you should notice is that there are more columns now. So in addition to the February forecast columns, I've added the governor's recommendations. And then along with that, there are two columns toward the end on the right side that show the difference between the governor's recommendation and the base. And that just means that's just the governor's recommendation for fiscal year 10 and 11 compared to the February forecast for fiscal year 10 and 11. So I don't want that to get confusing. Another thing I want to point out, in for this committee's jurisdiction, there was only one area, I believe, that was affected by the unallotment, and so that's on line 10, the kindergarten entrance assessment, under the governor's recommendation for fiscal year 2009. That number is $287,000, and that's $13,000 less than what was in the base. It's not a huge amount, I just wanted to point it out. And for the Department of Education programs, the biggest change, and the agency will get into that, but it had to do with the aid payment shift. And what that means is instead of doing a 90-10 split, the governor's recommending doing an 80-20 split, and I'll let the agency explain that some more. And then for the Department of Human Service changes in child care, the first recommendation was for child care reductions, and the total for 2010 and 11, and it was a combination of MFIP child care and basic sliding fee, the total was $10.4 million in reductions. And then for 2012 to 13, it was $10.7 million. What I want to point out, though, the number for line 35 under MFIP child care, if you look at the difference between the governor's recommendation and the base, it's a difference of $40 million. And part of the reason that number looks so big is that includes the TANF refinancing proposal that the governor had. And for that first biennium, it would be a $34 million reduction. But it doesn't go away for the program. It would be replaced by TANF money. And then for the recommendations for 2012 and 13, it would be a reduction of $56.5 million for general fund money, but that would be replaced by TANF money. And I think the department will go into that a little bit more as well.
Thank you. I think, members, what we'll do is keep these numbers nearby, but we'll hear from the departments, and I think they'll probably get into these more. So thank you for that,
sure.
Ms. Adrian. So we need to have the minutes approved. Representative Biscombs, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, and I'd like to move them.
Thank you. Representative Biscombs moves approval of the minutes for January 29th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved for January 29th. With that, we'll proceed with the testimony. Members, just so you know, today we'll be doing the governor's overview from the departments. On Thursday, we'll be hearing from the public and their reaction to the proposals. And then Tuesday, we will do our site visit. Well, Commissioner Segrin, we're happy to have you in front of our committee. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, we will try to go through our presentation so that you have some time for questions if you wish. I want to, first of all, just say that the governor is very interested in making sure that we have some quality investment in early child care programs. Particularly, we are interested in focusing on at-risk children, making sure that those students particularly are prepared and ready to come to school, ready to learn. We also have, as certainly part of our principle, to support parents in the choices that they may have for sending their students to, or their children, not their students, their children, to whatever program they wish. But we want those programs, of course, to be informed by quality. And I think that that certainly has been your goal here as a committee, is to make sure that we have information for parents so that they can make good choices as they're choosing a preschool program for their littlest children. To briefly remind you of the budget that we do have for early childhood, we have about $63.6 million in appropriations. About $20 million of that goes to Head Start, about $30 million of that goes to ECFE, and about $10 million goes to our school readiness program per year, which equals about, equals $63.6 million. We also are certainly have been looking over the last few years of how we can come alongside of our Head Start programs, our school readiness programs, and others, to ensure that they have some quality educational experiences for our students. And we've looked at changing legislation to increase the accountability and the quality of those programs. Our vision, MDU's vision, certainly for early childhood, is to support strong family involvement in whatever programs that parents are choosing. We want to make sure that we have outcome-based child learning standards that are aligned with our Minnesota Kindergarten Academic Standards. And, in fact, our early childhood indicators of progress are aligned, and that is really a nice thing to know, that as students are coming through an educational program that that is approved and has been aligned, that you'll be able to predict how well the kids are going to be doing. We also support research-based curriculum. We know that just any old curriculum will not do. Especially for our little children, that you want to have very high-quality curriculum that will support a child's not only academic development, but their social and emotional development, too. We really believe that teacher training is important, that and along with teacher training, having high-quality teachers, also having the support personnel that actually know how to work with children in an appropriate way is very important as they come alongside teachers in the program. And then we also want common research-based program standards across settings, both public and private, whether it's delivered in a Head Start program, whether it's delivered in a for-profit child care program. We want to make sure that we have consistent standards. And, of course, we want accountability for results, and I think you all do, too. You want to make sure that the investment that we are making for these programs, very important programs, are resulting in accountability and achievement. Again, I want to reiterate, we know that there are limited resources, and so if we have to choose, we certainly want to prioritize and focus on our most at-risk children. We are continuing, this is the sixth year that we've had our annual school readiness study, and we continue to see about 10% of our children, a little over 10% of our children, that are not ready at all for kindergarten, and that is a serious concern. It continues to be a very consistent percentage over time. And I think some of the initiatives and quality controls that we're discussing are going to, I think, over time really impact what's happening in our preschool programs.
Mr. Seeger, and of course I have to mention the 10%, and how do you get that 10% as opposed to 50% of kids being ready?
We have, you could call it a growth or progress model. The school readiness study has a continuum of progress. So you have those students that have no indicators of readiness, and then you have students that are in progress. So you'll have students that may be at the low end of in progress and those that are at the high end of in progress, and then you have those that are meeting all of their benchmarks. So you really have a continuum, but we know that for sure we have about 10 to 12% of our students that show no or do not meet any of those indicators. And then you have certainly kids in the middle that are on a continuum. And I always caution, particularly with preschool children, that there's so many, they develop at such different rates when you have a child from the age of 1 to 5, you may have times when you don't think that their language development is ever going to come along, and all of a sudden they burst into song, and they've got quite a repertoire. But other times, you'll see them just progressing at a very, systematic pace. So kids develop it at different paces, and so you don't want to, all of a sudden say, X number emphatically or not ready. So we want to caution that you should be looking at kind of the progression over time, and having that caution in the back of your mind as you look at some of these statistics.
Okay, thank you. I think that's probably a discussion for another day, but I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you. Yeah. Also, we certainly support parent choice. We think that's really important for parents. They know their children best, and one preschool program might be better than another preschool program, but across all, we want to make sure that there are good quality, so that when they are choosing, you know that they're choosing a good program. And I also just want to conclude by reminding the committee that on February 17th, we will be having our first meeting of the Governor's Advisory Council on Early Childhood Education and Care. We're very excited about that. Madam Chair is part of that council, and we're really looking forward to discussing a lot of the principles that I've articulated as far as best practice research around curriculum, about looking at the kind of quality outcomes that we want for students. And I think this advisory group will be very helpful and beneficial as we're going forward with the discussion on early childhood education. Did want to talk just a little bit about the unallotments. You may be wondering what we may not be able to do, and I think that may be in your packet. If not, we will not be able to print out our kindergarten readiness report, but it will be online, so people will be able to access that. And we were planning on doing some additional training, and we'll have to scale that back somewhat. The achievement task force that was put in place had a $50,000 appropriation, but that was conditioned on private funding, and that private funding never came to fruition. So those are my comments.
Thank you, Commissioner. We will have Mr. Melcher, and then we'll open it up for questions from the members. Mr. Melcher, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tom Melcher, and I'm the Director of Program Finance at the Department of Education. So we're going to walk you through the governor's recommendations relating to the aid payment shift, and I'm also going to touch briefly on the property tax shift, which indirectly affects this committee, but the dollars are actually carried in the K-12 area. There are six programs in this division that are affected by the aid payment shift that the governor is recommending. The general policy change that the governor is proposing is that all of the state aids that are paid to school districts that are currently allocated on a 90% current year basis, 10% final payment basis, would be changed to an 80% current year basis, 20% final year payment basis. On an aggregate basis across the overall budget for both K-12 and early childhood programs, there's a one-time savings to the state of $676 million. About $8 million of that is in the early childhood budget. The numbers on the spreadsheet that I'm passing around now are consistent with those that you have on the lines dealing with the payment shift on the spreadsheet that your fiscal analyst has discussed. And so you can see the impact in fiscal year 2010 is a reduction in state aid payments of $8,053. So essentially what will happen here is the school districts will receive $8 million less during the 2009-2010 school year on their current payments, and then they'll receive $8,053 more when they receive the final payment. So what we're doing is delaying some of the payments by a couple of months that crosses the fiscal year border. It's an accounting shift. So the school districts will still receive the same amount of money for early childhood family education, school readiness, etc., but instead of getting 90% during the year with a 10% final payment, they'll be getting 80% with a 20% final payment. So it's largely a one-time adjustment. The big numbers are in the first year, fiscal year 2010, and then you see some small savings to the state in later years, and that's because there are some increases in these formulas due to changes in demographics that cause slight changes from year to year, and as we continue with that 80-20 policy each year, there are some small savings, and so you see the $174,000 in fiscal 2011 and $150,000 in 2012 and the $242,000 in 2013. But the basic impact is that school districts still receive the same amount of revenue for the fiscal year, the way that they do their accounting, but their cash flow is slowed up. They have to wait a few months to get their final payment, basically, which will be a larger portion of the total amount of money. So it'll create some cash flow issues for the school districts. Those that are investing dollars will be able to invest a little bit less, and those that are borrowing will have to borrow a little bit more. But when all is said and done, given our current kind of interest rate situation, we don't see this as being a huge burden, especially compared to what the burden would be if we had actual hard cuts in the revenues for school districts. The second area that I wanted to touch on briefly, and it doesn't show up on your spreadsheets, is the property tax shift. The governor is recommending that school districts recognize 48.6% of their property tax payments for the calendar year in the previous school year. So the school districts get basically half of their property tax money in May and half of their property tax money in October or November. Under current law, the school districts take that money they get in May and they put it in the bank and they hold on to it and recognize it as revenue for the school year that starts, or the fiscal year that starts on July 1st. And under this policy, they count that as revenue right away when it arrives in May, and there's a subtraction against their state aid because of the early recognition of that money. On a statewide basis, for all of the levies the school districts make, basically a one-time savings of about $570 million. The levies in the Community Service Fund, which include early childhood family education and the Community Education Program, which are the two largest, account for about $33.7 million of the total $570 million. The actual savings are recorded in the K-12 budget because the dollars come out of the general education aid appropriation. So they're not, it's not showing up as a line item in your tracking, but the fact that there are levies for community education and ECFE does influence the amount of savings that the state does book in the general education area. So I just thought I would bring that to your attention as well.
Thank you, members. Other questions?
Thank you, Mentor. I would just say, Justin Ward and I are on K-12. We had a whole hearing on SHIP, and you know, we should all be aware that they, while they're, as Mr. Meltzer said, better than an actual cut, they are more one-time money that you know, only fixes things. We just push off the problem to another year, and then school districts have costs with their short-term borrowing.
Mr. Meltzer, that's kind of the question on the follow-up. Is that how they close that gap, is through short-term borrowing? Is that a typical scenario?
Madam Chair and Representative Growling, yes. I would say that there are many school districts that have a significant fund balance, and they do make investments, and so they will have smaller investments. So there'll be some loss of interest earnings in those districts. And for other districts that have a much smaller fund balance, they would be doing more short-term borrowing. So the net result is they're either earning less interest or they are paying interest.
Okay. Any other questions? Commissioner Feeder, and I just have one last question for you. Is federal stimulus money, any word on how that's going to come down through the Department of Education and maybe affect the early childhood budget?
Madam Chair, the last I heard, there was some money for Head Start, and I know that President Obama is very interested in early childhood programs. Might be some money for Even Start, although that program has really been cut for so many years. I would be surprised if we see any there. It sounds like mostly it's going to be Head Start monies that would be receiving some funds. The Senate got a different kind of proposal. I think they're looking at more block grant kinds of things. So I think we're just going to have to wait and see. I want to assure the, you know, committee that we're watching it very carefully, and many of the proposals, at least in the House, were just basically, you know, flow through right to Head Start, so we're not really involved in those kinds of things. The money would just go right to those Head Start consortia. But that's all we know right now. We're just watching everything very carefully and waiting to see what involvement we might have in it.
Thank you. If there is school readiness monies or any of those types of things, of course, we'd appreciate being involved too.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking for ways we can work together. So we'd appreciate
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I think right now we just don't know what the strings are going to be that are attached to it. I was on a conference call with the new secretary on Friday and with the other chiefs in the country. And we were talking a lot about the infrastructure appropriation, and there's a lot of concern just about how that money apparently possibly will be distributed according to Title I formula, which would not be a very practical way to do it, because you might have some districts that would get $5,000 in infrastructure money. And so we've been talking about how that could really be a little bit more practical way of distributing money instead of by a title program. So there's still lots of discussion about what the guidelines will be, and who knows, once the Senate does their stimulus package, then it's probably going to be another couple of weeks before it's conferred and back on to vote again.
Representative Downey?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think a question for Mr. Melcher. You show the shifts in your spreadsheet going out to biennia. And I know we did this before, and I think we switched back to 90-10, I'm guessing, after 4 years. I guess my real question is there a plan for how we get back to 90-10 at present? Or if there isn't a set plan, you know, what kind of triggers our ability to do that?
Mr. Melcher?
Madam Chair and Representative Downey, the changes that are being proposed here are the same changes that occurred in the 2003 legislative session. So at that time, when we had a $4.5 billion shortfall, we went to a 80-20 payment structure, and we also did the same 48.6% property tax shift. The last time this occurred, there was a look at this with each budget forecast, and it's up to each governor then to make recommendations as to what the changes would be. I think in the past, when we have done these shifts, there has been a priority to make payment back when the state budget picture looks better. But there's nothing in state law that I'm aware of that would automatically trigger that repayment. I'd have to double check to make sure about that.
Madam Chair,
Commissioner Segrin.
Representative Growling is going to jump in too, as the current finance chair and as the past finance chair. We probably back in the early 1990s, we had one of these tax recognition shifts, and it probably took us about 10 years to pay that one back. In 2003, we actually paid it back in 4 years because we made it a priority that we were going to, you know, pay that back and get it done. And of course, we had the revenues to do that. And that's what it's really dependent on, is whether we make it a priority and then we pay those revenue shifts back. So, and it's been growing.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Chair. Actually, it is in state law that we have to first, when we have extra money, we first have to pay back the reserve funds, have to be built back up again. And then the very next priority is K-12 education has to be, or E-12 education has to be put back in. So that's in our state law. But when we were paying these back last time, I do recall that the first, when we were getting ready to pay it back, and I thought, well, that's a very good thing. I was sitting on Ways and Means, and the proposal came from, at the time, Chair Jim Knobloch to change that law. So even though it's in law and it makes us feel good, legislators can change that law if we decide we don't want to pay it back and we prefer to spend. So I don't feel as comforted as I could if we didn't have that ability to change the law. But at least it's in there, and it is our intention. When we asked our economist, Tom Stinson, about what does this do to our bond rating to have all this debt and so forth. He said that he would have thought it would have harmed us more last time than it did because we paid it back so fast that it didn't seem to have as much of an effect. But, you know, if we string it out and don't pay it back, if we do, which I doubt we will, but if we would do that tobacco bonding and anticipation of revenue and, you know, if we do all these things that have nothing to do with ongoing money, I share your concerns, then I think we could ruin our bond rating for the short term, which is hard to get back.
Any other questions? Representative Lane.
Well, I don't know if we're going to have to do a shift like this or not, so these are just simple questions for what are the, you gave some sense that some of the districts had reserves that they could just use instead of having to borrow. What are two questions? One, what kind of numbers of our all the school districts we have that actually would have that kind of reserves? And second of all, are the school districts going to be able to find the money to actually borrow short-term for this?
Ms. Melcher?
Madam Chair, Representative, school districts on the average carry fund balances of about 12% of their expenditures. We have provided some information, I know, to the K-12 committee earlier, and we could share it with this committee as well in terms of the current kinds of reserves of school districts. But there is quite a bit of variation. Some school districts have much more in the way of reserves than other school districts do, and some school districts are actually in debt. We have a provision in state law called statutory operating debt, and we have around 20 school districts and charter schools that are currently in statutory operating debt, meaning that they're in the red to the tune of 2.5% of their overall budget. And one of the recommendations that the governor is making, and this is consistent with what was done in 2003 as well, is that for those school districts that are in statutory operating debt, there would be an exemption from the aid payment shift so that they would still be able to receive the full payment, at least in their general education aid, on the 90-10 basis if they were in statutory operating debt and the amount that they were in debt was more than this 10% that's being shifted. So there is some protection for the districts that have extremely low fund balances, actually negative fund balances. And majority of other districts do have significant reserves, but it will put a pinch on them, certainly.
Representative Lane?
Is money available for borrowing?
Mr. Melcher?
Madam Chair, Representative Lane, I think there are some issues in the financial markets, but my understanding is that school districts will be able to adjust their aid anticipation borrowing, for example. The state maintains a program called the State Credit Enhancement Program, which essentially puts the state's full faith and credit behind the borrowing that school districts do. So school district borrowing is considered very very safe and secure borrowing by lenders, and we believe that school districts will be able to adjust their aid anticipation borrowing and tax anticipation borrowing under state law to be able to address these things, but it won't be pain-free. But the markets will work, and they will be able to do the borrowing.
Representative Ward has a question, and then we're going to move on to the next testifier. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nelson, did you say that the school districts have about a 12% reserve fund balance, generally speaking?
Madam Chair and Representative Ward, yes, that's about the average. About 12% of their expenditures is in what we call the unreserved, undesignated general fund balance of the district.
Okay, and so, Madam Chair.
Representative Ward.
Isn't it true, though, and I know we've talked about this in other committees, that different reserve balances, fund balances, are dedicated for, you know, food supply or transportation or whatever. So is that figure that you're talking about, 12%, is that taking into account just the unreserved fund balance, or is it all you know, all fund balances that are not dedicated?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ward, that's only the unreserved fund balance in the general fund, and any additional fund balance the districts would have for food service or community education would be on top of that. But here what we're doing is looking at the unreserved fund balance that's not set aside for a certain purpose compared to the general fund expenditures of the district and looking at a percentage.
Representative Ward? The districts I represent, in the past have had a nice unreserved, nice is a good word, an adequate fund balance, unreserved fund balance, you know, to run the school districts in times of emergencies or whatever, but those have been significantly spent down to just for daily operating expenses. And you know, so if it's a 12% average in the state, there must be, I'm assuming then that there's some pretty healthy ones out throughout the state or whatever. The other thing I just want to point out is that as we had a great early summit here recently, and Commissioner, you were there. It was nice to have so many people there. You know, Lawrence and Jim Houlihan made a point about, you know, early ed is probably the best investment we can make. So as we look at it, county shifts, and we look at dollars, and we look at how much of it apply to TCFE, child care, Head Start, all of those, I think it's well for us to keep in mind, you know, many of the points that those folks made about now is the time to invest. Now is the time to make that kind of investment in our young people to move forward in our state. So I just wanted to make that point as well.
Thank you. Well, thank you for being here today and for sharing with us. And we'll have next Chuck Johnson and Jerry Kerber. Why don't you both come down at this point? Members, in between that, I wanted to introduce, we have a new page with us. So, new page, yes, that's you. Troy, if you want to introduce yourself, and when we did introductions in this committee, you missed it, but you have to tell us where you lived when you were 3 years old and what your favorite game is.
My name is Clay Bach, and when I was 3 years old, I lived in Tokyo Township, which is actually just outside Worcester, just in Alberta. And well,
your favorite childhood game?
Uno.
Okay, that was it. Yeah. Thank you. Welcome. We're glad to have you. So now, members, we have two pages with us, and we get everything out faster and so forth. So, and I think Representative Ward, is Troy your constituent now or was? I think you know him.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Troy is, and will be my constituent.
Well, good. There you go. Thanks. Well, welcome to the committee. If you want to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, Chuck Johnson with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I lived in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin when I was 3 years old, and my favorite game was Stratomatic Baseball.
Did we ask you?
Oh, thank you for that information.
But everyone who testified.
For some reason, Chuck and I always... No, we're happy to know that. Stratomata what? What was it?
Stratomatic Baseball.
Oh.
Long story.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I believe that you have... you may have 8 change pages in front of you related to the Department of Human Services. I'll be talking about 7 of them, and Mr. Kerber will be talking about 1 of them, if I'm tracking correctly. And I believe the first 3 pages I'm going to talk about are directly within the jurisdiction of this committee. The last 4 are maybe somewhat within the jurisdiction of this committee, but definitely touch on the business of this committee. I'm starting on what I have is called page 27, which is limit retroactive eligibility for CCAP. Does that comport with the way you're set up?
Well, we are members, we are tabbed. So I'm trying to figure they're all under the governor's DHS tab. And then 27 is the first page under that tab. So it's about the 6 tab back. So we'll see if the members, can everybody find it? Okay. Great. I think we're on the same page.
Madam Chair, this is a relatively technical proposal that relates to the Child Care Assistance Program. Currently under the Child Care Assistance Program, if someone can get child care assistance back to the point that they were eligible for assistance, this comes into play most often with MFIP families and the MFIP program, who can get child care back to the point they came onto MFIP as long as they're involved in work activities. And what happens sometimes is someone who's involved in work activities does not apply for child care assistance because maybe they don't know that it's there, they don't think they can use it, and maybe using a friend or a relative and not know you can get payment for a friend or a relative. Many months go by, when they find out they can apply, they come in and say they want to apply back to the point at which they became eligible. And this becomes a problem in terms of both program integrity and in terms of the work that it takes for the counties to dig through and figure out and verify whether someone actually had the expenditures, were they qualified, did they go with the elders when they were actually participating, and so forth. Right now, there is no limit as to how far back you can go. What we're proposing is to put a limit in that would say go back only 6 months for the purposes of retroactive eligibility and payments under the Child Care Assistance Program. That results, as you can see on the budget page, in small savings to the program. We brought this proposal forward last year as well, I believe. It didn't make it through. We're interested in doing it. The counties are supportive of it because it is a lot of work to do we have to do these kinds of actions. We have similar kind of limitations in other programs. We think it's appropriate for program integrity purposes that we do it here as well.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I believe the next page that you have is page 39, which is entitled Invest in Early Learning.
Mr. Johnson, ours is page 34.
Oh, I thought you had it in a different order. I can do 34.
No, our Invest in Early Learning is page 34.
Oh. Yes, that was mine, actually.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Madam Chair, this is a proposal that would allow us to capture expected underspending from the basic sliding fee program. This is federal money, Child Care Development Fund money, that we expect will be underspent by the counties for calendar year 08. We don't yet have the final figure. We do expect there will be some underspending. This would allow us to capture those funds for reinvestment to allow us to continue two pilots that we have going right now. So we think it would be important to continue for the purposes of the work Minnesota is doing around early childhood right now. The first one is the School Readiness Connections Program. Ms. Katolnik spoke to the committee about this a couple of weeks ago. This is a program that was authorized 2 years ago and was only funded for 2 years. It's within the Child Care Assistance Program. We essentially contract with providers who agree to meet certain quality standards for serving a concentration of low-income children, and we contract and essentially pay them somewhat more to do additional activities with those children. It's a way to target some of the resources in the program to some of the kids who are most in need, to tie it to quality standards, and to do it in a way that works through the Child Care Assistance Program in concert with the normal administrative practice we have within that program. The second piece is the quality rating system. Minnesota currently has a pilot out there called the Parent Aware System. I believe you also talked about this last week. That is a quality rating system for early childhood programs, child care and otherwise, that it is really, we think, provides a backbone for our early childhood activities. The benchmark, what we believe a quality program is, as a way to get parents information for making choices about the care they provide and the education they provide for their children, but also as a way for us to look at how we provide funding and where we provide funding within our current funding streams. This is in a pilot phase right now, and we know there's a lot of interest in looking at QRS in an expanded fashion at some point. We believe it's important to continue both of these evaluations, or both of these pilots, through 2011, which is when the evaluation research will be all together on these pilots, as well as on the scholarships that NELF is running in St. Paul, and the allowances which the legislature authorized in 2007 as well. All that research will come together in 2011. That's the point that we expect we make decisions around what direction we want to go for Minnesota. If we allow these pilots to end, we'll have to shut them down. If we decide they're a good idea, then we have to start them back up again. By continuing them, it allows us to move them forward. As you can see from the budget page for School Readiness Connections, this would be 2 years of continuation funding for 10 and 11, $763,000 in the first year and $760,000 in the second. And for Parent Aware, it would be 1 year of continuation funding for 2011 in an amount of $990,000. This basic right fee underspending is one-time money. We believe it's an appropriate use of one-time money. And for that purpose, we brought forward this proposal.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, could you remind me, because I'm new to this committee, what are we doing about the waiting list for sliding fee child care in the metro area?
Madam Chair, there currently are waiting lists, and Representative Bryan, there currently are waiting lists across the state, not just in the metro area, in the basic sliding fee program. And the counties manage the waiting lists, absent more money, there will continue to be waiting lists. But at this point, we don't have any plan of putting more money into that program to buy down the waiting list.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Maybe I just am asking the wrong question or don't know enough about it to ask the right question, but aren't we talking about taking the money from 520 child care, or is this something else that it's called?
Mr. Johnson. Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, the basic sliding fee program every year for the last 10 years has produced some level of underspending. Counties for basic sliding fees allocated a capped amount of money that they have to work within for the calendar year that they get the money. And the result of that, because they don't want to overspend, in which case they would have to use county dollars to make up the difference, is that they always end up coming close but not quite in terms of their spending, and we end up having underspending. Under existing current law, underspending in the basic sliding fee program, which would be is a federal child care development fund dollars, will go back into the basic sliding fee program and be reinvested. The last several years, that is not what's happened. The money has been captured by the legislature and refinanced for the purposes of addressing budget deficits or other needs that were before the legislature at that time. We're proposing a little bit different approach to either of those this year by instead capturing the money to continue these pilots. We do recommend that whatever would be left after the two pilots are funded would be refinanced, anticipating again that with the $4.8 billion deficit that we will need the money for addressing the budget deficit.
Representative Garland.
Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson. So every single county underspends.
Madam Chair, Representative Garland, not every single county, no. Some counties spend all their money, some counties overspend a little bit and are able to get reimbursed for that if there's underspending elsewhere.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, could you help me out a little more here? Why is it that there's such a huge amount that's left over when there are such waiting lists?
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, it's because it's very challenging for the counties to manage the allocations in the way that the basic sliding fee program is set up. They have to anticipate how many families are going to be on assistance, how long they're going to be on assistance, and what kind of care they're going to get, what the rate is they'll have to pay for that care, and as a result, they can be wrong sometimes. They may start a family in February and then book, okay, this family we're not paying this much a month for the rest of the year, and then that family moves somewhere out of state perhaps 5 months later, and then they have to find another family that may not be getting exactly the same amount of assistance, that might not quite fill it, and then at the end of the year, they're getting more families coming in, and so they're always trying to balance the inflow and the outflow of families to get at the right amount of money. It's challenging for them. We have discussions with the counties around this. The counties would like to see us manage the dollars centrally at the state level, where we could have a better way of distributing and ensuring that all the needs are being met. We think that may have merit. It is dependent on us having a statewide computer system to support us in doing that. We've just developed a statewide computer system that is still rolling out. Once that system is stable, this is an issue that we want to look at as a better way to manage the basic sliding fee child care program.
So, one last question. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. That was much more helpful. And so when will that computer system, so the counties want the state to do it, the state wants to do it, and the only reason we're not is because the computer system isn't up and running. And so when will it be up and running, and then will that end the taking of sliding fee child care that's so desperately needed for sliding fee child care?
Madam Chair, Representative Growling, one correction. I'm not sure whether the state thinks this is a good idea or not. I think we still need to analyze it more to determine whether or not it would be a better way of doing it. But that is something that we've committed to the counties that we will look at. I'm not sure what the timing would be. The counties will be fully rolled into the system about mid-year this year. That's at least the current time frame. Is that still around? Okay. Bringing the last couple of counties, Hennepin County particularly, into the system. And then we have to see if the system is stable and if it's meeting the day-to-day needs before we can look at adding other things onto it. That usually takes 6 months to a year. During that time period, we can start to analyze other options around basic sliding fee, but I'd say we'd be out till probably 2011 before we'd be looking seriously at this issue.
Well, Madam Chair, I just have one more then.
Representative Greiling.
Mr. Johnson, why wouldn't the state want to do it?
Madam Chair, we just want to make sure that we can do it in a way that's going to work correctly and result in a distribution of funds appropriately across the state. I'm not sure that it's just getting down in and looking at what the details are of actually doing that and how it would actually work. There are some smaller counties that are concerned that the money may get sucked up all by the bigger counties. One response that is, well, if that's where the people are and that's the demand, is that's where the money should be. But it can have to do with timing and how counties are timed at bringing families into the program. And so we want to look at all those issues to make sure that we're not doing something that's going to dramatically change the distribution of dollars, and we're going to really have the dollars going where the need is
and not where the counties that are good at getting folks into the system are.
Representative Reiling, this is kind of a trend. It's interesting, you know, we human services are generally county-based, so typically the money will go out to counties and all the human services. In the governor's proposal, there is another program, they are pulling back into the state, we all probably have constituents that are affected. So it's an interesting sort of trend that's happening. I think, you know, what this committee was concerned about the underspending issue and what to do with that, and then we passed legislation that it would be reinvested, and then I think it was a Senate proposal that took that money and gave it to another part of human services that had been cut. So it's kind of this vicious cycle, and now that we know it's happened, in other words, the Senate did that, then you see what's happening is the governor is now proposing it too, is that you can do that with these monies. I think it will be our debate, members, whether we want to do the same thing with that. And also, Mr. Johnson, how do we know how much money we're going to have to deal with in that underspending? Is there a date certain we would know that before?
Madam Chair, it's a settle-up with the counties, and we usually know by the end of February or early March what the final dollar amount is for underspending from the last year.
Mr. Johnson, can you be sure to send that to me?
Madam Chair, we definitely will.
Okay, thank you. So then Representative Rowling will at least know the number and be able to deal with it. Representative Ward?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Rowling, thank you for this question. It helped me as well. Mr. Johnson, just as we move forward with this, the counties, those little small counties that are afraid of having all that money sucked away from the bigger counties, that's real. So remember that, please, as we move forward.
Thank you. Well, let's proceed with the testimony. And we can continue asking questions throughout this. So.
Yes, Madam Chair, I believe the next page that you have is page 47, Child Care Assistance Program Reduction. Madam Chair, this page, as you heard earlier, has reductions to the Child Care Assistance Program to help us meet the $4.8 billion budget deficit. There are two reductions that are proposed here. The first is to the rates that are paid to providers. The maximum rates we pay providers are set in law. This would reduce those rates by 3% as of July 1 of 2009. That 3% reduction would produce about $9.4 million in savings for this biennium. The second change that is on this page is a increase in the co-pays that families pay. When families have income above 75% of poverty, they pay a co-pay as part of their child care assistance program. This would increase those co-pays by 3%. It would exclude those who have incomes between 75% and 100% of poverty, but would increase the income for those above poverty and up to the exit of the program, which is about 67% of state median income. The 3% is best to think of it in dollar terms. The statute actually creates the copays as a percentage of family income, but when we say 3%, it's not 3 percentage points, it's 3%. So in other words, someone has a $100 copay, today would have a $103 copay if this were to go into effect on July 1 of 2009. That saves just under $1 million, $972,000 for the 10-11 biennium. There is also a systems cost of $18,000 in 2010 associated with this proposal.
Mr. Johnson, are there questions? Do you have a breakout of what of the cost, how much is for, is the cut to the rate, and how much is the co-pays?
Madam Chair, we have that. That information is usually provided in the past in the budget pages. I don't know why it wasn't provided this year. We can get that information to you. If you have the full, I don't know what you have in your book, but there is a spreadsheet that does add back in my full book where you can see that breakout. I don't know if you got that as part of your pages or not.
Mr. Nelson, we do not have
that. Okay, we can get that to you.
We'd appreciate that. Members, are there any questions about this? Mr. Johnson, I just have one question then. When the federal government set up this program, wasn't it supposed to be that every child was treated equally and fair?
Madam Chair, there is in the federal law a requirement that we set rates that allow families to have access that is similar to care that is similar to the kind of access that others in the community have. And that particularly, as I understand it, means access to center-based care or family care or family-friendly neighbor care that we not differentiate within those different types of care. It also, in the way the federal government has treated it, does have as to, you know, are the rates able to purchase enough care within the community because they're at a level that's high enough to buy care. And as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, right now our rates cover about 40% of the centers in Minnesota charge at or below the maximum rates we have in about 55% of the family child care programs. So conversely, about 60% of the centers charge more than our maximum rates of pay in about 45% of family-based programs. And the federal government has commented on that in the case of Minnesota and in other states who have rates that are falling below, you know, falling down relative to the market, but they haven't done anything to enforce any change in rates in states.
So now, Mr. Johnson, you're saying that a family, parents out there that receive the CCAP monies and they're looking for child care for their kids, they're going to places and saying, I now have less money to deal with, less money. Will you take my child? Do you think the children will get the same opportunities as other children in the market?
Ma'am, sir, at the margin, it can't help but affect to some extent the access and the kind of choices that parents will have. I don't have an exact figure as to what that will look like, but it will have some impact in terms of limiting options for parents and the choices that they have. The 3%, this isn't related directly to your point, but the 3% I would comment is a similar percent that we've applied across the board within Department of Human Services to providers who provide services on behalf of our programs. So we came up with a uniform, essentially, way to treat all providers in the Human Services budget.
Mr. Johnson, can you give an example of some other providers?
Sure. Providers who provide services in the developmentally disabled, to people who are developmentally disabled, services in that community. Services under to people, elderly people in their homes. Services to people with mental health, serious persistent mental health, who are living in the community. Those would be the types of services.
Any questions? Why don't we'll move ahead, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that the next page that you have is, I'm not going to guess at the number until I get there, TANF-free financing, which is on page 54. The governor's budget proposes a number of changes that result in savings or reductions within the Minnesota Family Investment Program. When we make changes in that program, usually the savings that we get are in the form of federal TANF dollars. We also have recommendations to reduce or eliminate certain grants that are funded with TANF. The net result of that is that we end up with a TANF balance. In order to use that TANF balance to address the deficit in the general fund, we have to refinance to produce general fund savings. This is the page that essentially does that. It takes about $35 million in TANF that would be available based on the proposals in the governor's budget. It puts the TANF into the child care assistance program and takes out a like amount of general fund for the purposes of addressing the budget deficit. It doesn't change the budget, the eligibility, any of the other policies in child care assistance, just the type of funding that is used within the child care assistance program under the current budget.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to decide or to understand this just a little bit better. It seems like the two terms that I've been here, this happens each time that the TANF dollars are, with some paper juggling, are put into the general fund. They're taken out of, am I understanding this? They're taken out of the child care, or the funds that would go to children and put into the general fund to help with the deficit. Is that it, Mr. Johnson?
Madam Representative Peterson, in this case, the funds are being taken from several different places, but primarily the Minnesota Family Investment Program, our primary cash assistance program for families and kids, and several grants that were funded with TANF, where we're proposing to make reductions. So that's where the TANF savings comes from. But then, as you said, the TANF savings is taken put into the child care assistance program, because you can use TANF for child care assistance. That's allowed under the federal law. But in this case, the $35 million of TANF that's put in, is we simply take out a like amount, $35 million of general fund dollars, which then the general fund is used essentially to meet the deficit.
Madam Chair, you could just leave it in the child care assistance, right?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair.
And that's not the proposal, but you could do that.
Madam Chair, you could, yes, you could use it to increase the child care assistance program by $35 million, but then you would have the $35 million to offset the deficit, which was the point of making the reductions to the NSFIP program and those other grants I mentioned earlier in the first place.
That's kind of a paper shot.
Madam Chair, it is an accounting mechanism that we can use because of the flexibility we have in using the TANF dollars and the multiple things they can be used for that allows us to do this.
Representative Greiling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought that Ms. Peterson would ask the last question then, which I thought is where she was heading then. So this paper shuffle, though, does take money away from what I would consider the intended purposes, and it just goes into the deficit.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, it does take money away from the current purposes that it's being put to within Minnesota state law, which is the NSFIP and these grants that I mentioned, which are allowable purposes under TANF. It puts the money into child care assistance, which is also an allowable purpose under TANF. And the fact is that with the flexibility in TANF, you can do that, and you can back out the general fund, and as long as we have enough maintenance of effort elsewhere in the state's budget to meet our TANF maintenance of effort requirement, it's perfectly legal for us to do that, and there isn't any prohibition on doing it.
Well,
Representative Greiling.
I wasn't saying it was illegal, but it doesn't sound really moral.
Representative Greiling, and I think there's at an initial point when you get TANF, there's sort of, you know, what is TANF and what is your MOE and how does it go together to meet whatever you think your program is. When you get 10 years out, it's very confusing to determine at this point anymore what is TANF and what is the MOE within our program, because the money is so fungible and we've used it in so many different ways. But you're not the only person who's raised the objection to whether this is the intended purpose when you're making a very specific maneuver that is intended to offset our current problem, which is the deficit, or move the money to something that might be outside of the realm of what TANF would allow, which other states have done for completely other purposes. That has been questioned often, but it still is allowable within the TANF law.
Representative Peterson?
I don't want to belabor this. I'm still trying to understand it. Going back to the TANF grants, what were those grants used for?
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I can, off the top of my head, tell you all the places that we've reduced TANF. There are a number of changes to the NSFIP program that result in TANF savings. There is a reduction to the NSFIP consolidated fund, which is essentially a block grant that funds the services the counties provide to people who are on the Minnesota Family Investment Program. There is a grant that was created, or program was created a couple of years ago to support something called integrated services projects that we're proposing to eliminate. That was funded with TANF. And most of the money is really in the NSFIP changes. We're proposing some changes that would count other public benefits against the NSFIP grant, which would reduce NSFIP grants to families. That results in where most of the savings come from.
Mr. Johnson, Representative Mariani.
Well, I just want to, I'm struggling to understand it too. I understand the broad parameters that the federal government has allowed, this kind of flexibility. But as I'm reading the notes, and the maintenance of effort requirement to match this maneuver is increasing the allowed use of the working family credit. So how, and I could follow up with you more later, but how does that not create budgetary, issues for the state? Because I'm thinking simply that means more money for the working family credit over and above current expenditures. Am I thinking about that right? Or?
Mr. Johnson.
I'm sure, Senator Mariani. Up to a point, you're thinking about it right. The working family credit is allowable source for us to claim as maintenance of effort for TANF. Mm-hmm. Right now, we claim a certain amount of working family credit for our maintenance of effort requirement, but we don't claim all of the possible current existing state general fund appropriation that's in the working family credit that we could use for maintenance of effort. So what this does is, and there's a rider in law that governs how we handle maintenance of effort, is essentially would increase the amount of maintenance of effort we could, the amount of maintenance of effort we claim through the working family credit for the purposes of offsetting the loss of maintenance of effort that we'll have here because we're putting TANF into the child care program. So it doesn't, it's again more of an accounting maneuver to say which dollars are we pointing at and saying this is our maintenance of effort this year, next year the maintenance of effort may be somewhere else, but we can shift around, and it's in part because Minnesota has a reasonably rich amount of spending on programs that qualify for maintenance of effort that we have the ability to maneuver and have this flexibility.
So currently we're not using working family credit as an offset, as a maintenance of effort offset, or we're not using the full possibilities of working family credit.
Mariana, we're not using the full possibilities of the working family credit currently.
Representative Riley?
Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, we're not only not using it, it looks like we have to change the state law in order to do it this way.
Madam Chair, Representative Darling, that's correct. That's the riders that I referred to before. There are riders that govern how we are able to claim maintenance of effort with the federal government, and that rider needs to be changed in order to facilitate the refinancing.
Madam Chair,
Representative Gray,
I hope that you or someone is talking to the federal government about how this is actually being implemented. It seems to me they don't have enough controls over what they are allowing here, so that I don't think they're sending us money to have us use it for the deficit.
Representative Grayling, you make a very good point. This is a conversation we've had ongoing, and usually at this point it's kind of like Groundhog Day. At this point I usually say to Mr. Johnson, can we please have the amount of TANF that has been refinanced over the last 10 years?
Mm-hmm.
Will you get that to us?
Madam Chair,
or is that actually in here?
Since TANF began, we've refinanced a total of $255 million, which is about 7% of the total of the block grant that we've received over that time period.
Mr. Johnson, do you have that on a list anywhere? I know we provided that before to us.
Yes, Madam Chair, we can provide that to you.
Okay. Thank you. So Representative Grayling, that's your answer, is it has been done a lot. In committee, we can talk about this more. When the Republicans were in charge, we used to think it was worse, and now we're doing it. So, I mean, I just have to say, it's done by both parties, you know, and proposed by both parties, and sometimes implemented by both parties. So it isn't really a partisan thing either. It becomes on both. Representative Hamilton?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, for pointing that out. And the point I wanted to make is that the governor's recommendations are just that. They're recommendations. And the best part about it is we in the legislature, and especially when you're in the majority, you have the ability to bring up your proposals and your recommendations as well. And then we can start working towards the compromise. So I appreciate your comment as well, Madam Chair.
Yeah, well, thank you, Representative Hamilton. It is, because we often, I don't know, if they used to take up the Human Services Bill, Health and Human Services, like at 5 in the morning. We've been through a few of those, and this was all discussed then. And so that's why it may not ring a bell completely, but we've been doing it for many years. Doesn't make it right. We could change it. That's what we're here for. So appreciate the input. Why don't we proceed, and I think that'll come up again. Representative Downey?
I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just trying to get a bigger picture, conceptual understanding here, but if we were just kind of in the aggregate in the state, meaning the bare minimum of maintenance of effort, would we be able to make this move, or is it because kind of collectively across programs in the state we're somehow above the minimum threshold of maintenance of effort that we can actually make this shift? Is that a fair way to understand this?
I think that's a fair way to state it, and it is because we have MOE that goes beyond what the bare minimum would be. much of which is existing outside of what one would normally think of as having been the old AFDC world that became the TANF world. It is the Working Family Credit, for example, other kinds of supports that are outside of what may traditionally have been thought of as the welfare system.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll proceed, and I just want to say also, Representative Greiling, I will follow up. Typically, the writers show up in Representative Huntley's bill, so I will be talking with him more about that as well and how that works. Mr. Johnson, do you want to proceed?
Yes, Madam Chair. I believe the next page I have is page 55, correct base level adjustments. This is what it sounds like. It's a technical page. Essentially, there were some errors made last year in the riders. And some of the base level were not appropriately represented for certain programs. This makes those corrections, and as you can see, it has a small cost in each of the 2 years in biennium. Madam Chair, I believe the next page that you have is page 30, is that correct?
Yes.
Fraud prevention investigation. This is the proposal that Chair referenced before. Madam Chair, this is a recommendation from the Governor that effective November of this year, responsibility for the fraud and prevention investigation program be taken over by the state. The fraud prevention investigation is the main recipient for our control effort that we have, focusing on food stamps, MFIP, and our medical programs, as well as the child care assistance program. This started in 1990 as a pilot, has expanded now. It's really complex, traditional fraud control kind of work that will continue to be done at counties under this proposal. Focusing more on early identification of potential problems with cases and administrative remedies, that is using claims and collections to get money back, using civil procedures rather than criminal procedures, disqualifying families from assistance rather than trying to prosecute them and put them in jail. It's thus more efficient, a little bit easier to use. Currently, this is operating in 55 counties. There are 31 investigators across those counties. It's funded with $1.5 million of a state grant. The counties then use that to leverage federal reimbursement, and the total budget, when you put those two pieces together, is around $2.8 million a year to support it. The problem with this program is with the flat state funding, we're facing a situation where we can't afford to continue to pay the counties to do the work they've been doing at the level they have over the course of time. We're not fully covering the costs anymore within the program. Over time, to continue to do what we do, either the counties would have to pick up more of the cost, or we'd have to begin to reduce the amount of service provided, the amount of investigations we do within the FBI program. In looking at the options of how to address this, we came up with a proposal that we thought works best, which is to have the state take over the fraud prevention investigation program. So to essentially move the $1.5 million back to the state, we would get the same level of FSP, as you can see from the budget page. This would be done basically in a cost-neutral way. There's a small savings across the 4 years that come from this. We believe that by centralizing this function, we can operate it more efficiently and more effectively. Currently, investigators within FBI in the county-based program handle about 17 investigations per month. But when you look at the best-performing programs, they're handling 25 to 30 investigations a month. We believe we can get more up into that range operating on a statewide basis. And as a result, we believe we can do more investigations and cover all 87 counties by centralizing this. Also, we can develop consistency, have more common practices in how we do this, have better communication across the program in terms of what kinds of fraud to be looking for, what kind of patterns we're seeing, and also that we can prioritize and direct resources more efficiently. We propose that this would add, I believe, 28 FTEs to the department, 25 investigators, two supervisors, and a support person. We'd have it fully implemented by February 1st of 2010.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Johnson, how much, for every dollar we put into this, how much money do we save?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, we estimate that we have about $4 per dollar spent in what we call cost avoidance, which is dollars that aren't spent out because we've stopped the fraud at a certain point in time.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else on this?
Madam Chair, no.
Members, I'm going to be meeting with Mr. Johnson, and I have a constituent happen to be one of the fraud investigators. And so, is this, Mr. Johnson, creating jobs? Is this just are we losing jobs because we're taking them away, or are they going to get the first opportunity to apply for these jobs? Is it job sort of neutral, I think is what you said, or?
Madam Chair, there are about 31 investigators now, so this would be slightly fewer in terms of total FTEs, but it's a little bit hard because some of the investigators are funded only part-time, so the 31 is a bit of an estimate. We would certainly encourage anyone who's currently an investigator to apply and interview for the jobs. We haven't talked about getting necessarily first dibs to those folks, but certainly as experienced investigators, they would be people that we'd be looking for these jobs.
Mr. Johnson, how many of those jobs are in rural Minnesota right now?
Madam Chair, I don't have a breakdown of how they are right now. I could get that for you. We anticipate that some of the staff will be located and living outside of the metro area. We also anticipate that most investigators will not be spending time in St. Paul, but will be spending time out working in the counties hopefully on a regional basis where you can develop the right kind of relationship between the investigator and the counties that they're working with.
Thank you. I think we all want to make sure that we're not losing rural jobs and bringing them just here to St. Paul. So if it's a kind of a wash, and if I could see the breakdown, I think that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, we can get that for you.
Okay. Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Johnson, for the counties were using state appropriation and not the federal funds, would the state be doing the same? Would the state now be leveraging those federal funds as well?
Madam Chairperson Marianne, that's correct. We'd be leveraging the federal funds as well. That's why we're able to do it within the same budget.
Okay, members, I think we have about five more minutes for how many more pages do you have to go here?
I'm sure. I believe I just have one more.
And you're going to talk about MSIP too, I'm sure, right? Mr. Johnson?
I don't know if you have that page, and I was going to talk about it.
Okay, let's just want to make sure. Thank you. Who want to tell us about the last page?
I believe the only page that I have left is page 57. This is a federal compliance page. It is a request for an FTE to do case reviews as part of an Improper Payment Information Act of 2002. This is a federal act that Congress passed that looks for vulnerable programs. I think there may be programs where are vulnerable to misappropriations and improper payments. And the federal government has determined that the Child Care Development Fund is one of these programs that should be under this act. They've issued regulations which will require us to review cases and determine if there are improper payments, make paybacks where there are, and then also institute procedures where we will learn from where there are improper payments, try to correct issues going into the future to develop a better and more integrity around how the program issues payments. In order to do this, we need an FTE, and this page is essentially the cost of the person to do this work.
Okay. Are there no questions? Did you want to proceed?
Madam Chair, the committee was interested in the MFIT proposals that had an impact on child care assistance. There are two proposals in the MFIT area that impact child care assistance. Do you have the pages, Madam Chair? I wasn't sure if you had them out. Okay, I'll just explain what they are. The first is a reduction to the MFIT exit level. Currently, when a family is on the MFIT program, they can earn up to 115% of the federal poverty level before they exit the program. We're proposing to reduce the exit level from 115% of the poverty level to 110% of the poverty level. As a result of that, some families currently in MFIT will lose eligibility. Some of those families are also currently using child care assistance. So what happens is there ends up being a child care effect from this change as well. The estimate is that in 2011, there would be 15 families that would lose child care eligibility for a savings of $84,000 in that year. The second change that we're proposing in MFIT that would also impact the child care assistance program is a change to the vehicle asset limit. In 2007, the vehicle asset limit for families on MFIP was increased to $15,000. We're proposing to move that back to the level it had been prior to that, which was $7,500. That also results in some loss of eligibility for MFIP families, some loss of eligibility for MFIP families, some of whom also receive child care, and there's about 23 cases, and that results in savings of $13,000 in fiscal year 10 and $267,000 in fiscal year 11 within the child care assistance program.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say that the criticisms I have of early childhood, Representative Hamilton's comment, I don't think are partisan. I think the Democrats haven't been very good on early childhood things either, and I've been part of some initiatives that have, you know, tried to, along with Representative Mariani over the years, trying to get, and then Representative Slawick when she's been here, trying to get more funding into early childhood. So I think I'm just condemning the whole result that we seem to have year after year for early childhood. But I'm wondering if you, Mr. Johnson, could, I won't say the same about other areas of the budget, but early childhood, I think we all could be blamed for not doing better. Do you have any facts or figures about what happens when people are not qualifying anymore sooner for MSIP and they lose their child care? What does that do to people that are able to work and get themselves off of welfare and have their children properly cared for? Is there any fallout in people being able to make it?
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, it certainly has an impact on the families that are affected by it. The change in the exit level in this program will be affecting families who are working families who have an income that is above poverty but not necessarily a very high income. But they would be families that do have some resources. In theory, most of those families should qualify for the transition year child care program. The estimate that was done fiscally on here is that some may not because they don't have activities to qualify or because they don't follow through to do it. So there is a small savings from that. Certainly we know that when parents don't have the dollars to pay for care for children, then they try to cobble things together as best they can using family and friends and others who will not charge as much or will pay free. And that is a concern anytime we're making reductions or not meeting the needs in the child care assistance area.
Members, we have about 10 minutes. We're going to have Mr. Kerber go. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Well, just because you had to wait all that time, Mr. Kerber, you're now going to have to tell us your where you lived when you were three and your favorite childhood game, because Mr. Johnson did.
Oh, gosh. Members of the committee, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the director of the licensing division of the Department of Human Services. And when I was three, I lived in Excelsior, Minnesota, and in fact, in the same house I'm living in today. So I haven't gone very far. My favorite game at age three, I probably would have to say maybe Candyland.
Yeah, Candyland. Okay, good. Well, thank you. If licensing is new to us, members, we have not had it in this policy committee before. We have it from Representative Thiessen, has now, not that we've taken it, but we think we have more interest here. We want to know what's happening. So if you could tell us about the changes.
Okay, Madam Chair. The change that I will talk about here is page 21 and 22 of the book. And I think hopefully you have some handouts as well. Another three-page landscape document, a couple of spreadsheets. And what's happening here is at the Department of Human Services, what we're trying to do is restructure the funding for licensing activities somewhat. There's, just a little bit of background about our division. Not to take too much time, but we license about 25,000 programs. About 4,000 of those we monitor directly with DHS staff, and the other 21,000 we license, but we work through counties. And so the other 21,000 includes things like adult foster care, child foster care, family adult day services, and family child care, which is of interest to this committee. The directly licensed programs include things like chemical dependency treatment programs, mental health treatment programs, services for people with developmental disabilities, and child care centers. There's a few others in there. What we're kind of reacting to here is there's a principle that's set out in Chapter 16A that says that for an agency to collect a licensing fee, it should be about right. It should neither significantly over nor under collect to recover actual costs. And in fact, that's how most licensing functions in state government operate. And they collect their licensing fees and their deposit into the state government special revenue fund, out of which they get their appropriations, and they're kind of independent in some ways from the fluctuations of the general fund. That's where we're seeking to go with this. However, in order to get there, one of the things we have to do is we have to raise our fees to actually recover some closer to the actual cost of what our licensing functions are. And so for what we're proposing to do is to do this over a two-year period where we'll raise our fees. Our fees currently, when we collect them, they go into the general fund, and that's where we get our appropriation. Over 2 years, what we want to do is increase those fees half the first year, half the second, and then transfer our relationship over to the state government special revenue fund. So ultimately, our fees will go there, and that's where we'll get our appropriations. What our fee increases don't affect is family child care. When we were only talking about the types of licenses for which we currently collect a fee, and those are those 4,000 that I mentioned. Family child care providers may pay a licensing fee in your county, but they pay that to the county. And there's a county licensing fee and a county background study fee, and that's totally separate from what we're talking about here. We don't charge a fee for family child care providers, and we're not proposing that. So where our fee increases are proposed in the child care world is for child care centers. And as you can see from the handouts that you got, it costs us about $1.5 million a year to do licensing of child care centers, and that includes site visits by our, you know, roughly 9 licensing staff, and we do maltreatment investigations, and we do background studies. We do complaint investigations. Our licensing fees, we're fortunate in the child care world in that some of those costs, about 40% of our costs, are taken care of by federal funding we get. We get some Child Care Development Fund, and then we also have some other federal funding for Title IV-B that we use to augment or to subsidize our child care licensing activities. So what we're talking about doing here is increasing our fees by a mere $88,000 the first year and then another $88,000 the second year. And so what we do in this proposal is distribute that across our child care centers.
And so how much does that wind up being?
What, Madam Chair, what that ends up being is $70 the first year and $65 the second year. And so the handouts you have kind of break that down a little bit. It talks about the smallest programs we license are in the first year, they're going to go from a $225 licensing fee to a $295 licensing fee. That's on page 2. The third page is licensing fee changes in the second year. In the second year, they're going to go up another $65. So it'll go from the original today's fee of $225 to $360 a year.
Mr. Kerber, we just want to make sure the numbers, it's the pages that look like this. It's up in this corner here, so it shows the actual fees in the top of the, what is like the second and third pages,
mm-hmm.
the 225 to 295, 295 to, well, the range to 1570.
That's correct.
Does everybody see that? Mm-hmm. I think you might hear from your child care centers. I'm not sure, but you may be hearing from them. I mean, maybe we'll hear from some on Thursday when we have public testimony. Anything else you want to add about that?
Madam Chair, I just might point out here that those fee increases are relatively moderate compared to some of the others. If you look down the row here, residential mental health programs for adults or children's residential facilities are going to be going from $400 a year to $4,400 a year. And so those fee increases are very much more dramatic than these. And the big difference here, of course, is that we have some federal funding that we use for to subsidize our child care licensing activities.
And members, I'm going to call on Representative Guyland, but I also want to clarify that we have the policy here, but our funding is still financing in Representative Huntley's committee. Is that correct, or is it in TSA?
Madam Chair, that is correct. It's still Representative Huntley's committee, as I understand it. And one thing to keep in mind here, this is not any kind of appropriation increase. This is merely a fee increase to make the general fund more whole. It doesn't add any appropriations to the Department of Human Services for this activity.
Representative Greiling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure the Health Representation Committee will look at the increases for the mental health system, but I'm looking on page 21 of the restructure licensing funding, and it says by collecting the necessary fees, the activities will no longer be funded with non-revenue dollars, and therefore there will not be any federal financial participation to be claimed for these activities. How much federal money do we lose?
Mr. Kerber?
Madam Chair, we lose about, about 40% of the difference between our full appropriation and our revenue. And so our full appropriation for this is $4.5 million. We collect $2.1 million. And so the difference is $3.4 million. And it's 40% of that is what we lose.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Representative Garling.
Seems like that's a very good deal.
Mr. Kerber?
Madam Chair and Representative Garling, there are some, you know, there is a loss of that money. You know, there that is true.
Well,
Representative
Garling? I don't even know, Madam Chair, what to say about that.
This is our first exposure to this. That's interesting math.
Madam Chair, the FFT is really only awarded on the difference, on the payment from the general fund that is not matched in any way by any kind of revenue that we collect. And so it's where we collect about, you know, right now we're collecting maybe 40% of what its appropriation from the general fund is. The FFT is only matched on that other part. On that, for which there is no revenue, and so this is seeking just to increase the revenue.
Mr. Kerber, it seems like that money that we're losing, it total, we wouldn't have to do all these fee increases, would we, if we had that money? Or what? I don't understand why we're doing this,
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair, Representative Garling, there's a couple reasons we want to do this. And that is really to kind of move this structure to be more like other licensing functions in the state, where it's independent. The funding of licensing activities, which is sort of a consumer protection function, is independent from the fluctuations that we encounter with the general fund. If there's an administrative budget reduction to general fund dollars to the department, you know, that affects, then there needs to be a prioritization done all the time. Do we stop maltreatment investigations? Do we stop visiting child care centers? Do we stop some background studies? What do we need to stop doing? The idea here is that if, like other agencies, the licensing function is more fee-driven, it's where the customers are paying for a service here, if they paid the right amount, we wouldn't have to engage in that kind of conversation.
I think, members, we've reached the end of our time. Representative Garling, any last question?
Madam Chair, I see it very penny-wise and pound-foolish. I just can't imagine. I hope we don't do this.
Representative Garling, that will be up to the committee to debate. And I think, Mr. Kerber, if you have any more details at some point, if you want to do a follow-up, we sure appreciate it. Thursday, we'll have testimony from the public. With that, the committee is adjourned.